Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, live from the Green Space. Good morning again, everyone. Joining me now is renowned historian David McCullough. He's won two Pulitzer Prizes for his biographies of Presidents John Adams and Harry Truman, also the National Book Award. He hosted The American Experience on PBS for 12 years, narrated Ken Burns' Civil War documentary, and has even been given our nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. David McCullough is also known for his speeches that often contextualize contemporary issues with pertinent moments from American history. That may all be moot now, as we may have jumped the shark of American history as we know it 89 days ago. We'll find out what David McCullough thinks. But he's curated and edited 15 of his speeches for his latest book, The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For, in hopes that they will, quote, remind us of those things at this particular moment. Please welcome David McCullough to WNYC and the Green Space. And listeners, we can take some phone calls for David McCullough at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Just for a little political context around the current moment, you've kept your political views private for most of your career, but you came out strongly against Trump, I see, during the election campaign. You're 83 years old. Why now?
Because I felt that we were going down a very dangerous track, and that we had to put the brakes on and stop and consider who we are, what we stand for, and are we going to dispense with all of that in order to put someone in the pilot seat who's never, ever flown a plane before and who doesn't understand how our government works, who has no interest in the history of the country and has said so on more than one occasion, has never read a book about the presidency or a biography of a president, and claims, as he said in an interview in the Washington Post, that he doesn't need to read books because he knows so much intuitively. And I remember Jefferson said, any nation that expects to be ignorant and free expects what never was and never will be. We are a country based on the love of learning, on the improvement of our way of life through learning. We are people who believe in the truth. We are people who believe in tolerance, who believe in hard work, and having aspirations beyond material acquisition. And we want to bring our children up that way. I've dedicated this book to my 19 grandchildren because I hope that what I have to say will extend beyond my own children's generation to the new one coming on. And I really know from a lifetime in the field that I've made my specialty that one of the best of all ways to learn about almost anything is to read history. And that history isn't just about politics and the military. It's about life. It's about art and music and dance and science and finance. It's about human beings. It's not boring statistics. It's not memorizing dates, heaven knows, or quotations. It's about human beings and how we can attain aspirations that we may think impossible if we work together.
I see at a speech that you gave at Dartmouth in 1995 that's included in the book, while stressing the importance of reading history, you said, I don't think we can ever know enough about our presidents, and particularly before putting them in the job. The truth is, of course, it makes an enormous difference who is in the White House.
A tremendous difference. And we can't expect an exceptional president every time. Exceptional presidents, as I try to tell students, exceptional presidents are the exception. But they do happen, and they often happen in a surprising way. Harry Truman, I think, probably being as strong an illustration of that as anyone. And they're very different from one another. I have known through interviews or time spent with seven of our presidents, and they are all interesting figures and all quite different from each other. The two I know best are Harry Truman and John Adams. And I was asked once at the end of a talk I gave at a university in California, the questioner said, aside from Harry Truman and John Adams, how many others have you interviewed? I had to explain that appearances notwithstanding, I did not know John Adams or Harry Truman.
And I heard, who was it, W.E.B. Du Bois, making a comeback these days?
Yeah, right. That wonderful line of Gerald Ford's, if Abraham Lincoln were alive today, he'd be turning over in his grave. Gerald Ford, by the way, is a much misunderstood president. He was much more important and admirable president than he's generally perceived as, and an interesting presidency. He didn't last very long, but an awful lot happened. And there's a good man working on a good biography of Ford now, I understand, which I'm very pleased about. I spent much of one whole day with him, and I was so struck by how different he was from the way he had been portrayed. You know, the fellow that wore his football helmet, well, played without his helmet, and would fall down when he got off an airplane. A president can make one little mistake like that, and just they don't let up on it. Lyndon Johnson loved to tear Ford apart unfairly.
He was president for such a short amount of time.
Yes.
After the impeachment, or the resignation, prior to impeachment of Richard
Nixon.
And
nobody ever had to be interviewed for the job, and be passed on by... Well, anyway.
Were you just impressed with him as a person when you spent time with him? Or
yes.
Is there something about his legacy in the White House?
He had finished the White House, and I was invited to the Ford Library in Michigan to come and give a talk. And he showed me around the museum, but talked at length and quite candidly about various people and about various problems. And I was struck by his... He seemed to have both feet on the ground about the work. He was a very professional, full-time public servant his whole working life. And it's a profession. It's a trade. You have to know it. You can't just jump right in and think, oh, I know how to do this. It doesn't work that way. And the qualities that I think are essential above all are strength of character.
Uh-oh.
Well, on the mantelpiece in the White House, there is a line carved into the marble that's taken from a letter written by the first president ever to occupy the White House. That was John Adams. He was there overnight for the first time of any human being that's ever been president. And his wife was delayed in coming with him, and he wrote her a letter in which he said, among other things, may none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof. And that was carved, first of all, Franklin Roosevelt had it carved into the wood of the fireplace, and then President Truman, when they rebuilt the White House, had it replaced. And then John Kennedy, when he was president, had a change made, had it carved into the marble so it was certain to last. And what I think is so powerful about that is he said, may none but honest and wise men. He puts honest first.
And he put men in particular.
Yes. Well, that's all we knew yet. And still, but honest and wise men. And those are the fundamental values of tolerance and optimism and the capacity to use the English language. Imagine that. Imagine. And to think before you speak.
is the amount people would push back. You know, there are Trump supporters who push back on that he's really actually brilliant at using the English language. Was it Bannon? I realize that quoting Steve Bannon on Donald Trump, but I think it was Bannon who said he's the greatest orator since William Jennings Bryan. He gets these crowds.
What do you want? You want me to...
Well, I mean, you know...
That's ridiculous. Abraham Lincoln? John Kennedy? I was asked to give the memorial talk at Kennedy's memorial service in Dallas just a few years ago, 50th anniversary. And I went back and reread Kennedy's speeches. And, oh, my goodness... Breathtaking, thrilling. And one of the things very interesting about Kennedy is he almost never talked, think of this, never talked about himself. Mm. The first person singular very seldom enters in. And the idea that he said, we will go to the moon, that's American. That's we can undertake... Hitherto is seemingly impossible accomplishments and succeed if we work together.
My guest here in the green space, excuse me, on the Brian Lehrer Show is the renowned historian David McCullough. His new book, a collection of speeches that he's given over the years, is called The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For. We can take some phone calls for David McCullough at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or if you have a question for David McCullough here in the green space, raise your hand and we'll come around with a microphone. We're being, you know, pretty direct here about Trump, but I'm going to continue it. Is the amount of lying at the level of just making stuff up outside the norms of American political history,
yes,
or is it naive to think
yes,
that?
Yes, it is.
It is.
But let me make a point that I think needs to be expressed by lots of us. The job that the media is doing today, print to be sure, but radio and television too,
internet too,
excels any performance of their responsibility that I know of in our past. It's superb. They are rising to fill the very role that the Constitution declares to be their responsibility. And it's some of the best reporting, the fairest, most accurate reporting that I can remember. And when they publish the things that are being said on a weekly basis as kind of a calendar of this last week's of what aren't true, that's marvelous. And because who are we to know if somebody doesn't remind us what he just said isn't true? And what is so disturbing is he doesn't seem to care. Now, do we want to raise our children and grandchildren on that kind of ethical standard? And
what does it say to you about the American people, in whom I think you have great faith?
I do.
That so much of this was known during the campaign at the level of character, and enough people to elect him voted for him anyway.
That enough people were sufficiently distressed about their place in life and how the fortunes of life seem to be so often against them, that they were willing to grasp out at almost any snake oil salesman who happened along. That's my interpretation.
In your speech to Ohio University in 2004 in the book, titled The Bulwark of Freedom, you said, when bad news is riding high and despair is in fashion, when loud mouths and corruption seem to own center stage, when some keep crying that the country is going to the dogs, remember, it's always been going to the dogs in the eyes of some. Is that a good quote for today?
I hope so. I meant it then, and I mean it now. I think that we are a good country. 90% of us are great people, good people, wanting to do the right thing, work hard every day, try to be at work on time, raising our children as best we can, educating them as best we can. And we shouldn't lose heart because there's always so much bad news in the forefront. Bad news moves newspapers and brings people to television. I'm concerned that we are becoming a nation of spectators, and I'm very concerned about the influence of big money on politics. I think we all ought to be very concerned about that and stop it as soon as it's possible to stop it.
And by the way, I'll just use that as an opportunity to promote our next guest, who, after David McCullough is finished here, will be Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, no mere spectator. She is one of the organizers of the March for Science, which will be taking place this Saturday, Earth Day, in Washington and around the country. So stay tuned for that coming up in a few minutes. Let's go to a question for David McCullough here in the green space. Hi.
Hi. I'm interested in hearing about how you've seen the role of history in political discourse change over the course of your career as a historian. And I say that because Donald Trump is in some ways aggressively ahistorical, but his campaign has also kind of drawn on a mythological history of America in an interesting way.
And your question is?
So my question is, how has the role of history in political discourse changed?
The role of history in affecting political discourse?
Or how people use history in making political arguments.
If it has.
I really don't understand the question.
I guess he's asking...
Try.
How do politicians use history to convince Americans?
Politicians traditionally have all been using history, knowing history, and using it effectively from when we first began as a country. We have never had a great president who wasn't a scholar, a reader, a believer in history. You can just see them all the way along. Woodrow Wilson was a professor of history. Theodore Roosevelt wrote an excellent history of the Naval War of 1812 when he was still in college. Dwight Eisenhower's Crusade in Europe is, I think, one of the very best books ever written about the history of the Second World War, and he wrote it all himself. Harry Truman, who never went to college, never stopped reading history. He said the only new thing in the world is the history you don't know. And he understood that what presidents don't do is often as important as what they do do. So when he decided that he would not use the atomic bomb in Korea, that was a momentous decision. When Eisenhower decided, I will not go into Vietnam, another immensely momentous decision. And the history is about cause and effect, and history sets examples of leadership. The best leaders are all readers. It's been true all along. And you can't ignore the life of the mind, and you can't ignore the lessons that history teaches us in all of aspects of life.
Politicians often misuse history, I would imagine, in making points that are either inaccurate or don't create accurate analogies to things that are going on today.
Yes, well, anybody can find something in the Bible that makes their point. And history is much like that, because history is many-sided. History is human. That's the essential thing to remember.
On the other hand, I remember when Michelle Obama said, I'm living in a house that was built by slaves, and that may not have been something that has been on Americans' minds, and she brought it back to the fore.
Well, it should be brought back to the fore. The first president to occupy the White House, John Adams, never owned a slave. Never owned a slave as a matter of principle. Because he didn't believe it. He thought it was wrong. His wife felt even more strongly on the attitude. The next president who didn't believe in slavery was their son, John Quincy Adams. We had seven presidents who were all slaveholders. But at the same time, keep this in mind, our country doubled in size with what was called the Northwest Ordinance, which brought in what are now the states of Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Illinois, and the Congress of the United States, before we had a constitution, the summer of 1787, passed the Northwest Ordinance, in which it was ordained forever that there, in that territory, there would be no slavery. That was equal to half of all the country and territory. Now, granted, there was no one living there except Native Americans at the time. But nonetheless, it was a huge step in the right direction, which we don't pay any attention to or give any credit for the very people who let the Constitution go through without having slavery.
We have a question right here, I think. Hi.
Hi. Professor McCullough, if I understood you right when you talked about why Trump was able to be elected by enough people in this country to become president, do you think there's some way in which Obama's presidency set us up for Trump at this time?
Well, there's unquestionably an element in our country still that feels not at ease with an African-American president, as there are many people who were against Mrs. Clinton because she was a woman. But at the same time, we elected Barack Obama. And at the same time, let us not forget that Mrs. Clinton won the election with a popular vote of nearly 3 million people. So it is, the loser is the total loser. She wasn't a total loser. She was, in fact, the winner. And that ought to give us inspiration. That ought to give us hope that we can approach male, female, black, white in a fair and open-minded way.
Also on the dissatisfaction in the land today, as a historian, maybe we have lived through an ahistorical bubble of good times in this country after World War II that is just not sustainable unless the whole rest of the world is on its knees and unless technology ceases to progress. And so we have today's sense of decline from the standpoint of the wealthiest country in the history of the world. And maybe it's an ahistorical bubble, and we need that context to even begin this conversation.
No, I don't agree. I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. Because, yes, you can say we're on decline, but in many ways we are not on decline. We are on the upward path. Look what has been accomplished in our lifetimes in medicine. My God. Unbelievable. That happened here. It didn't happen anywhere else. Look what we've created in our higher educational system in this country. Now, yes, well, there are problems with it. Yes, it's become too expensive. But we've created the greatest universities and colleges in the world in our lifetime. And that's no minor achievement. We've also given more opportunity to more of our people of all kinds and races, colors, everything. And let's never forget that we are all immigrants.
Obama made a big point of saying we're living at the best time to be alive in the history of the world. It sounds like you agree.
I do agree. That's not to say we don't have problems, but we have always had problems. Problems are what we call life. And if we're going to think, oh, we got a terrible problem, then we're spoiled brats who haven't any realization of what happened before us. We have to know what our predecessors have been through, what they sacrificed, what they did in the cause of improvement, of progress, of both emotional and intellectual and physical and material progress. What they went through in the Civil War, what they went through in the influenza epidemic of 1918-1919. Most people don't know anything about that. 500,000 Americans died in less than 1 year of influenza. If that were to happen today, given our population, it would be 1.5 million people would die from a disease that we don't know where it came from, we don't know how it is going to go away, and so forth. Imagine that on the nightly news today. What a state of agitation and frenzy and madness we'd be in. But they got through it, just as they got through the Depression and those horrendous world wars.
Anthony in Greenberg, New York. You're on WNYC with David McCullough. Anthony, you there? Can we bring Anthony up? Can you help me in the control room? There we go. Anthony, I think we have you now. Actually, control room, give me a hand on this. There we go. We have you. I apologize, everybody. It's a little different in the green space to put the calls on the air. Hi, Anthony.
Yeah, I'm a great fan of him. I have a history degree from Mercy College. And I wanted to say, he just said something really, really poignant to me about how white people have become dissatisfied in this country and feel like they've been left out. You know, I'm black, and we've been left out for 200 years, you know, and nobody ever recognizes that. They say all of a sudden white people are so disaffected, so disenfranchised. Well, black unemployment is still down. You know, black pay rate is lower than white people's pay rates. You know, I mean, I don't understand. What do they think President Obama gave black people? Because he became president, we didn't raise up any. Mass incarceration is still there for our people. Most of us go to jail for big crimes that white people don't go to jail for. You know, and I don't understand why they're so dissatisfied. We've been dissatisfied. It's not like we won anything when Obama became president.
What's the legacy of Obama for you, Anthony? Is it nothing in particular?
That we elected a president. No, that we elected a black man as president.
I hear you.
And that
brilliant man too, a brilliant black man. He was a good president. You know, on the other hand, I still think when people talk about deportation, nobody cries. Obama deported more people than Trump has deported right now. You know, but nobody. He had his shortcomings, but.
Anthony, I think I accidentally disconnected Anthony. But Anthony, we get your points and keep calling us. You're back on the. Oh, okay, you're done.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. One. I apologize, Anthony, for being clunky technically on your call. One more thought.
Yes, I think Harry Truman said you have to wait 50 years for the dust to settle in order to judge a president, and it's very hard to say how history will treat Barack Obama. My guess is history will treat him very well. He brought to the White House a sense of balance, not just about the racial makeup of our country and the injustices that black people have endured, but he brought an intellectual level to the White House that was superb. And I didn't agree with everything he did, but I thought he brought also a marvelous First Lady. And he was and remains a gentleman. He showed us how to behave like a grown-up gentleman of responsibility in the most important leadership role in the world and in all history. Nobody can do the job perfectly. Nobody can be in there more than a couple of months and not make mistakes. But that's the nature of it. And we have to be very careful what kind of people we choose and what kind of people we encourage to pursue a life in public service. We must not let politics become a responsibility, a role as citizens, which nobody wants to have anything to do with anymore. We need to summon the best that's in us to take these roles.
I want to thank David McCullough and Simon & Schuster for giving a copy of David's new book to everybody here in the green space. Thank you so much. David McCullough's new book, a collection of his speeches, is called The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For. Thank you so much. It's been a great honor.